Hey there, and welcome to episode number 148 of Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is September 1970. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And mine is Jamie Wenger.
Folks, if you are listening to this episode on the day it comes out, then today is the day when we record our 150th episode live in Portland, Oregon.
Woo!
At 7 p.m. tonight, Wednesday, March 30th, we will be at the Lucky Labrador Brewing Company on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, talking with our good friend, New York Times bestselling author, Chelsea Kane.
Whew, it got hot in here all of a sudden. It's so sweaty in here.
Among other things, we're going to be covering an Avengers issue that dares to finally take a stand against all those pesky women's libbers. They've had it too good for too long, and Roy Thomas is going to put them in their place.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I think Chelsea will have a thing or two to say about it. Should be fun. Tickets are free. You'll need one to get in because, space is limited and fire codes and such. Are there any tickets left? Who knows? That is 2 weeks away from where we are at right now. Anything could have happened between then and now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like living in two time periods at once.
It is
like a Star Trek episode right now.
Yeah. But if you check our Instagram feed, which is at Marvel by the Month, and our Twitter feed at Marvel BTM for the latest information, you will be able to find out, where and how to reserve your seats if there are any seats left to reserve. Also here's a little pro tip. Even if the show is sold out. I mean, we're not selling to, is it still a sellout? If
occupied out,
occupied out. Yeah.
Fire coated out, capacitated.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. That sounds pretty final.
If the show is capacitated, we are probably going to be hanging out, there after the show, until they shut down around 9:30, cause it is a school night. So come on by, even if you can't have a ticket, and we would love to see you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to see you.
Yeah, I would like to see you. I'm less excited about you seeing me. That part, that feels a little bit less enthusiastic.
I'll shower. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, so, okay. That was all about episode number 150. We still got to get through this episode 148, guys. Last show, bit of a bummer. It was all about death.
Yeah.
This week's show is all about Doom. Dr. Doom.
Yeah, all right,
the doctor is in.
Yes, Marvel's greatest villain appeared in three different stories this month. We are going to talk about them all. Our Patreon supporters will hear about all three stories in the extended version of this episode on our Patreon bonus feed. But you're going to get at least one of them for free. That's our promise to you. I do feel like we might be slightly infringing on our friend Douglas Wilk's podcast premise. So maybe we should throw a little love to Voice of Latveria.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
A wonderful Dr. Doom-centric podcast.
Are there more coming?
As far as I know, he's been recording them.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So hopefully by the time you hear this, they may have hit the pod waves. I don't know,
but keep trying.
Yeah. It may still be on hiatus, but the back catalog is deep and rewarding. Highly recommend it. Rob and I have been on individual episodes.
Yeah, there are episodes with our voices upon them.
Yeah, delightful listens, I might add.
I think individual, too. We went solo, which is weird because we're conjoined.
Right, super.
Like, I just had to sit there while he was talking about this Dr. Doom story that I really wanted to comment on, but
yeah, they rigged up a curtain to go like between them,
and the ball gag thing helps, but yeah.
sure, always.
I think the episode that I recorded was when we had that crazy heat dome in Portland. It was like 120 degrees.
Oh god.
And like you can hear it in Douglas and my voices, like we're just like, just kill us now.
Must dig underground.
We're here to talk about the Marvel Comics of September 1970. Before we start talking about those, though, we're going to start off by taking a look at some of what was happening in the world of September 1970. Rob, why don't you take it away?
Sure. September 2nd, 1970, NASA announced the cancellations of the Apollo 18 and Apollo 19 manned lunar landing missions, which had been scheduled for 1973 and 1974, respectively. The Apollo 20 manned mission had been canceled on January 4th, 1970. The scrubbing of the missions was estimated to save $42.1 million in the upcoming fiscal year, but also meant the layoff of 700 NASA employees.
Mm. Boo to all of that.
Yep.
Man, space took a hit.
Yeah, brutal. On September 3rd, 1970, 57-year-old Vince Lombardi, legendary American professional football coach who guided the Green Bay Packers to six NFL titles, died from colon cancer. On that same day, Alan Wilson, American rock musician and co-founder of the group Canned Heat, died of a barbiturate overdose at the age of 27.
Wow.
Yikes.
Bad day for football and rock and roll.
Wow.
On the 5th of September, 1970, the Detroit Triple Fanfare took place at the Howard Johnson New Center Motor Lodge in Detroit, Michigan. The three-day convention for fans of comics, fantasy book, and science fiction movies dedicated its program to Jack Kirby.
Oh.
Guests of honor included Philip Jose Farmer and Jim Steranko.
Cool.
And the event drew 225 registered attendees.
Oh my gosh. They must have been psyched too. That like,
like 200 and something people. This is nuts.
Yeah. We've combined our three fan bases and pulled in over 200 people.
Wow. On the 6th of September, four passenger aircraft were hijacked on the same day in an operation carried out by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which boarded airliners from four different airlines that were departing for Europe from New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport. 1 week later, on September 13th, the PFLP released 257 of the 312 hostages that it had taken in the hijackings. The Palestinian guerrilla group continued to hold 39 hostages, all of whom were Israeli citizens whom the PFLP classified as prisoners of war.
Whoa. Yikes.
On that same day, Jimi Hendrix performed his final concert in an appearance on the West German island of Femern. He was found dead 12 days later in London from an overdose of sleeping pills.
Yep.
Bummer.
In other rock news, on the 9th of September, Elvis Presley began his first concert tour in more than 12 years after years of having performed regularly in Las Vegas. Presley opened the tour in Phoenix, Arizona, and over a period of 6 days, played at arenas in St. Louis, Detroit, Miami, Tampa, and Mobile, Alabama.
Whoa.
On the 10th of September, the Chevrolet Vega, General Motors' entry into the subcompact car market, was introduced at 6,300 dealerships in the U.S. with the slogan, "Chevy's new little car is open for business." Wow.
That's a slogan.
Yep.
That is definitely a slogan.
The price for the first model, the Vega 2300, was $2,091. John Z. DeLorean, at the time the general manager of GM Chevrolet division, said that the car was unlike any other Chevrolet ever built.
You could say that again.
But it did not yet have gullwing doors.
Yes. On September 11th, 1970, the Ford Pinto, the second subcompact from the Ford Motor Company, after the Ford Maverick, was introduced in the United States and Canada. Overshadowing GM's rollout of the new Vega the day before, Ford announced that the car would sell for $170 less. As part of the company's marketing, the Ford Pinto was sold in Maryland to an elementary school teacher, Mr. Pinto, who lived in Pinto, Maryland.
I have a weird Pinto fact.
Okay,
bring it on.
By about
do we have a sting for Pinto fact?
Pinto fact.
Meow.
Probably 10 years later, my family's junkyard and many other junkyards were full of Pintos.
Oh,
there were a lot of Pintos when I was growing up. Yeah. That's it.
My only Pinto association is a Chris Rock routine, that funnily enough.
Oh, yeah.
I can just hear him saying the word Pinto.
One of my very best friends is a Mr. Pinto.
No way, really?
Yeah, oh. There you go. We've all shared some
a little personal anecdote about the word Pinto.
It's Pinto by the month. I'm sorry, everybody.
That's what you tune in for. The 12th of September, 1970, Dr. Timothy Leary, former Harvard University professor and advocate of recreational drug use, escaped from a minimum security prison near San Luis Obispo, where he had been serving a prison sentence for possession of marijuana. Having gotten a job in the prison yard as a gardener, Leary climbed over the wall of the institution along a telephone wire, then located a pickup truck that had been parked nearby by the Weather Underground Radical Group.
Yeah! Free your mind.
And your body from prison.
Perhaps more importantly.
The group then smuggled Leary and his wife to Algeria. He would remain a fugitive for more than 2 years until being arrested in Afghanistan and brought back to the U.S. on January 18th, 1973. That is how seriously the Nixon administration will go Holy after someone smokes. Got busted for grass.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically a political prisoner at that point, right?
Oh,
yeah,
totally. Okay. Man.
Yeah.
That's insane. On the 13th of September, the first New York City Marathon took place. With 126 men and women running, the first marathon consisted of a little more than four laps around New York Central Park's walking paths and was won by Gary Mercht, an FDNY fireman.
You want to take that name one more time?
Mercht.
I don't think you're wrong, which is the crazy
Mercht.
No, it just kind of, it boy. It
Mercht.
Yeah, those are some consonants.
It's just like it's a boggle line.
It sounds like a monster that Kirby created in the 50s.
Right, right.
Watch out for Mercht.
On September 19th, The Mary Tyler Moore Show began a seven-season run as a situation comedy about a woman starting a new career as an associate TV news producer. Reaction to Ms. Moore's return to television after having been a co-star of The Dick Van Dyke Show were generally favorable, with one critic noting that she is back where she belongs as a girl with spunk in a TV series.
All right.
They don't write them like that anymore.
I mean, they'll have to apologize if they do.
Yeah, enough ropes.
On the 24th of September in 1970, Dennis Kitchen founded Krupp Comics Works, better known as Kitchen Sink Press, in Princeton, Wisconsin. Over the next three decades, Kitchen Sink would publish some of the most groundbreaking indie underground and adult comics titles in the industry, including Omaha the Cat Dancer, The Crow, and From Hell.
Hey.
And in 1974, they would co-publish Comics Book with Marvel Comics, an attempt at packaging an underground comic magazine for Marvel Comics to distribute. Hmm. It was too tame for actual underground comics, too risque for Marvel, and it folded after five issues.
I respect the instinct.
Yeah,
you tried.
Yep.
On the 25th of September 1970, The Partridge Family, a situation comedy about a fictitious family of pop musicians, premiered on ABC television. Only two members of the cast, Shirley Jones and her stepson, David Cassidy, could actually sing or play a musical instrument. A team of studio musicians and singers recorded the popular record albums and singles, which the actors would lip sync to during the filming. Within a month, the first Partridge Family song, I Think I Love You, was ranked in the top 20 of best-selling U.S. singles by Billboard magazine.
Nice.
It is a very catchy song.
I got it on a mix in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. So that is a little taste of what was going on in the world of September 1970. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk about the Marvel Comics of September 1970 right here on Marvel by the Month. Hey everybody, this season each episode of Marvel by the Month is being brought to you by one of the finest sponsors that 1970s comic books have to offer. Rob, who have we got this week?
So last week our sponsor was Wallace Brown Cards, and if you took our advice last week, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take all of those Wallace Brown cards you ordered and throw them directly into the trash.
Oh, hey.
Wallace Brown cards are garbage, and in the garbage is where they belong.
I don't know about this.
Olympic Sales Club is where it's at, my friends. The Olympic way is the in way. Here's why. Olympic sample book is free. It contains samples of fast-selling Olympic cards, and it's yours to keep. They don't send you boxes of cards in advance like those other idiots.
Oh, hey now.
With Olympic, you never have to worry about paying for or returning boxes you don't sell, because only some kind of dirtbag would ask you to do something like that.
I don't think we should be calling them dirtbags.
That is literally the worst business model I've ever heard of.
Rob, I'm looking this over, and it really does seem like the Olympic cards are in.
Yeah.
All you do is show your attractive sample box to friends, relatives, neighbors, and take their orders. Olympic cards sell for only $2.95 a box, and they're worth much more. Sell enough boxes to get all the prizes you want, or keep $1.05 per box. And now about those prizes. You want an AM/FM portable table radio? All you have to do is sell 12 boxes. How about a knife and axe set? that's just six boxes. Or maybe you're interested in a Polaroid swinger camera. Sell only 10 boxes and it's all yours.
It's easy to join Olympic. Just fill in and mail the postcard. No postage is required. They'll send you the free sample book, free membership card, and free catalog of prizes. There's absolutely no cost to you. Don't wait. Join now. It's easy.
Guys, I don't want to get us in hot water. Does this seem like all these sponsors are just pyramid schemes to take advantage of children?
How dare you?
Okay, we are also supported each and every week by our patrons, who subscribe at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth. Even though we have started accepting sponsorships from partners like Olympic Sales Club, honestly, yeah. I'm really starting to have second thoughts about that. Our Patreon supporters are the ones who actually make it possible for us to make Marvel by the Month week in and week out.
And everyone who supports us at the $4 a month level gets access to the Marvel by the Month bonus feed. There'll be extended versions of each and every episode that we release this season on that bonus feed, including this one. And 24 of the episodes that we recorded last season have expanded versions on that feed as well, not to mention Patreon-exclusive bonus episodes.
And here's the thing. If you are listening to this and you're thinking, guys, I'm so glad that you do what you do, but I really don't need more than an hour or an hour and 15 minutes of you each week. Believe me, we get it. You don't need to listen to the bonus feed. You can still support us and help make it possible to continue making this show. You are under no obligation whatsoever to listen to longer episodes.
Although, pro tip, if you listen to them at 1.5 speed, the extended episodes are actually shorter than the regular episodes played at normal speed.
Our Patreon supporters also get first dibs on tickets for our 150th episode live show, and they're always first in line to hear about what we've got coming up. There might even be a couple of surprise and delight things in the works.
So thank you so much to all of our patrons for your support. If you'd like to become one, head to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth and sign up today. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. I am going to take us through Thor number 182, our third Doctor Doom story this month. This one's called The Prisoner, The Power, and Doctor Doom. It's right there in the title, so you know you're going to get some Doom.
What a weird title.
Yeah, you know they wanted the alliteration, but just couldn't land it.
Yeah. It's also, it's funny because... The cover clearly shows that Doom is in the issue, but it's like Stan really wanted to make it clear to everyone, you know, who is looking at comics on the newsstand, is like, no, Dr. Doom is definitely in this issue. It's like we showed him and we wrote his name on it.
Right. Make no mistake.
And the cover is great. You know,
yeah.
Teaser.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think this is the first time Thor and Dr. Doom have crossed paths. I don't think they have ever. Because Doom and the Avengers faced off in Avengers number 25, but that was like when it was Cap and Quicksilver and Hawkeye. It was that era of the team.
Okay.
So Thor was not a part of it.
I don't think they interacted at all for the Fantastic Four wedding. Like,
no, you know, I don't think so.
And if they did, it was with 400 other superheroes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Wouldn't have really counted.
Yeah, exactly. So... this is kind of a big deal that Doom and Doom occupies literally half of the cover of this issue.
Oh yeah.
The cover is beautiful. It's a John Buscema Joe Sinnott cover. Dr. Doom's in the foreground. He's holding his mask in his hand. And lame Dr. Blake is cowering in the background with the ghostly form of Thor hovering above him. And Doom is saying, "Now that you have seen me without my mask, you cannot leave here alive." So just looking at this, putting myself in the position of a kid in 1970, there is a lot to convince me to part with my 15 cents here. You got Dr. Doom's in the issue. We might get to see him without his mask. Compelling. I mean, he's holding the mask in his hand right there. And he might kill lame Dr. Blake. So
this could be the biggest win of Thor ever. This is just a weird aside. Again, I'll just sideline right out of the gate. Let's do this. When I was a kid, because Doom was from Latveria, and the only, the vaguest idea I had was to compare that to Transylvania.
Sure.
So you were not alone. He sounded like Bela Lugosi's Dracula to me. And so Doom, when I was a kid, always sounded like a really menacing Dracula.
Cool.
Oh, I love that.
And so he was the best villain too, because my brain had already cast this voice into him. And I'm like, I want to ask Douglas what he thinks of this. And I'm sure he's already mentioned it, knowing him. But I just like, it just seems like he'd have this weird sort of exotic Eastern European, you know,
yeah,
accent.
I buy that completely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not even a stretch. Like, that makes total sense.
With like a robotic tinge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
this menacing low thing.
Like, yeah. Ring modulation in his voice. Yeah. No, I love that.
All right. I'm out. Thanks.
Thank well, you. Good night.
Oh, yeah. Let's do the comic stuff.
Let's talk about this issue.
We haven't got past the cover.
So the story begins.
Wait. I want to interrupt again.
Oh, yes.
The cover, the difference between the art on the cover and the art on the first page is very striking.
Yeah.
Like
the cover. It's the same team.
That's so weird to me. Doesn't the cover look like 10 years younger than the inside?
It might be the coloring.
I think maybe the cover with the all the inking and the color and the like shading on the armor, like the shine, the reflections, like that feels both more Bronze Age and less like I somehow less cool as the as when we get in here and see Sinnott inking this, you know, normal splash page.
It also is like, I mean, you have, you know, Doom taking up, you know, the right side of the pay of the cover, like full figure. And, you know, like I think we talked about the last episode, Stan was reining John Buscema in and having him not do stuff like that on the interior. So, I mean, this seems like really impactful and bold. And I feel like when we get into the story, there's not as much of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, these weird camera angles and sort of movie staging where someone's, you know, real, like having the villain in the foreground looming over the tiny, fragile, you know, hero, Blake.
All right, now, sir.
He's our hero. Yeah. Okay. And so, for the purpose of your bit, lame Dr. Blake is the hero.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just wanted to be clear.
Yep. Just clarifying. No further questions. So our story begins with Thor overlooking the city of New York, where a one-woman protest is taking place in front of the Latverian embassy.
Awkward.
Thor decides to change back into lame Dr. Blake to investigate. He quickly realizes what a terrible decision that was when the crowd starts to become unruly. They just kind of get into a fight because there's one person protesting, and some people think that all protesting is bad, and some people are like, she's got a right, and they just start fighting with each other over whether protesting is good or not.
Yeah, I feel like this a lot of the stuff in the most recent protest books we've been reading, and especially this month, all are like, this is where you get your, like, the previous administration gets like all of its lingo for, right? These are long haired creeps. These are anarchists. Yep. These are rabble rousers. These are whatever.
Yeah. I was thinking about this, just earlier today, actually. And I was trying to like sum up like where I think Stan Lee's politics are. And I think if you go through the Marvel comics of the time, and you go through the ones that Stan wrote, I think you have a very, very accurate view of this is the most liberal thing that a Republican of the time would have endorsed. Oh, yeah.
Right, right.
So, yeah, you don't have to like the protest, but you have to agree with, you know, the right to do it. So,
right, right.
Yeah. The crowd becomes unruly. The single solitary protester is knocked to the ground. Blake changes into Thor to disperse the crowd, and then he carries her to safety. He changes back into lame Dr. Blake in order to tend to her wounds in his office. And she tells him why she was protesting the Latverian embassy. She introduces herself as Cosette Lafarge, daughter of Professor Lafarge, who was kidnapped from his home in France by Latverian soldiers. The Lafarges were brought to Latveria on the orders of Dr. Doom, who commands Lafarge in a very weird and creepy passive-aggressive manner to build him some missile silos. And
we both landed on page six.
Page six. Okay. Yeah. Why don't you two Why don't you two put on a show? Rob, if you want to use the robot.
I don't know
vampire,
if I can, but I will try.
But yeah, you just go ahead and read. Start with Lafarge saying, Jamie, okay. You will be Lafarge. You cannot do this to a citizen of France.
I'm going to skip the offensive French accent, if that's okay.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's acceptable.
And I probably can't do an accent at all, but we'll do something.
You cannot do this to a citizen of France.
But I have done nothing, mon ami. You have come to visit me of your own free will.
You are mad, you know that is not so.
Have you not offered to serve me to construct new missile silos for my use?
Never, never will I put my talents to the use of the world's most dangerous monarch.
I thank you for the compliment, but alas, you speak too quickly. Bring in the child.
My daughter, Cosette, you fiend, you would threaten me with her?
Do not be afraid, my dear. Threats, Professor? Who speaks of threats?
Enough, I can bear no more. I will design your silos, but no harm must come to my Cosette.
My sentiments exactly, Professor, and to make certain your daughter suffers no harm, she will remain within my castle, in my care, until the missile silos are completed.
Yeah.
And scene.
It's just like, the way that he is just like, he is not even... This is very like, I mean, it felt like Vladimir Putin kind of like,
yeah,
just sort of like, no, I'm not even going to buy into your reality of the situation.
I have broken no laws.
Yeah. He's chill in his, he's reclined. He's literally, Dr. Doom is reclined in the first panel.
Yeah.
And then when he calls the girl in, he's like kneeling.
Yeah.
Like you would do to talk
like
to
holding
kid.
Her little chin.
Her little chin, yeah. It's like, it's so strange.
Yeah. It's like the most menacing. It's like a super great Bond villain. Right. It was just now trying to, you know, act, which is not one of my arts. I was like, he's menacing, but he's super cash.
Yeah.
Which makes him more menacing.
Right.
Because he obviously is not afraid of anything that he could possibly, Lafarge could possibly do it.
Right, because he's got a whole other castle underground.
Exactly. Yeah,
this goes sour, he's just taking
earthquake
that,
this thing. Boom.
Yep. Escalator downstairs.
So Professor Lafarge presumably gets to work on those missile silos. And Cosette is attended to at all hours by Latverians, who are ordered to keep her healthy or else. But the Latverian underground eventually helped her escape the country. And she came to the U.S. to find sanctuary.
Worth noting, a lot of time has gone by. Like, she's like a little child.
Yes. It's been years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But those missile silos are almost done. So, wait, was she rescued by Rudolfo's forces?
That would be mint. I don't think so, but that would be mint.
I mean, it's not in the text, but, like, if you're trying to, like, continuity.
Yeah, it's members of the underground in Latveria. Who rescue her. So, huh.
But when does that take?
They take place in this. Well, so this had to happen earlier. Oh, yeah.
This
right?
would have happened 10 years earlier or something.
Well, this was
five. I don't
know. Her escape might have only happened fairly recently, but it was at least probably a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah.
But it could have been the same underground. Yeah. The same underground that was propping Rudolfo the alliance with Rudolfo. So there you go.
I think that tracks.
Yeah.
I think that Stan should have taken an extra second to think of that and write it into this story.
Right.
I mean, I know he's a busy guy.
Yeah, I don't know if Stan's reading all the Marvel comics at this point.
He's like, Larry, what's happening in that Doom thing?
Yeah.
And Larry's like, okay, there's the head pops off and it's got spider legs. He's like, okay.
Fair enough. Yeah. Never work with your brother.
Yeah, kids today.
The missile silos are almost done, which means that soon no country on Earth is going to be safe from Doom. But what's going to happen to Professor Lafarge once his work is done? Lame Dr. Blake says, don't worry, I've got a plan.
It's a weird plan.
It's a weird plan.
It's the best dumb plan.
So you might be saying, it's like, well, I mean, he's Thor. Why doesn't he just go to Latveria and destroy these missile silos, right?
With a giant, you know, god hammer.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or thunder, whatever. Lightning specifically.
Yeah. Whatever you got. but he says, well, Thor can't attack a sovereign nation, even one that's ruled by Dr. Doom. It's like, okay. It's a weird place to draw a line, but.
He's technically from Asgard, so he's got diplomatic immunity too.
I would like to think it's because of the Avengers, because of his association with the Avengers. If he goes to town on Latveria, they get in trouble.
Okay.
Which could also be written into this comic, but isn't.
But specifically was not. Right, right. Good point. Good point.
So what he decides to do is, after Cassette leaves, lame Dr. Blake calls up problematic journalist Harris Hobbs, who, if you'll recall, once kidnapped Jane Foster and held her captive for several issues.
Yeah. What a guy.
So Blake pitches him on a fake story, and because Hobbs is either a corrupt journalist or just a terrible one, he just runs it. Suddenly, Odin summons Thor to Asgard.
Yep.
And Thor gets to Asgard. Odin says, it's time to talk about the world beyond.
Whoa.
But Thor is like, I am totally up for that talk. I am right in the middle of something on Midgard. Can I please just wrap that up first? Sif and Baldur very much want to go with him back to Midgard. But Odin apparently has a one in, one out policy. So he's like, he sends Thor back to Midgard. And when he's done, and he says, when Thor's done there, they'll talk about that wondrous world beyond
Mordor.
So this is a real subtle tease being planted by Stan about upcoming storylines.
Wow, that's so funny. If you're reading these now, like, you're just like, noise from the 70s. Like, this is not salient or relevant. Or
I feel like this entire season, could we just replace 30 minute chunks of this podcast with noise from the 70s?
Oh man, but you're totally right. That's a tease for what will probably come next.
Yeah, especially with Stan, he usually doesn't like throw, or you know, there's not some panels with other characters,
right,
unless he's trying, that just show up briefly,
right,
unless he's trying,
he's
to
putting
do
down
something.
Tracks.
Mm-hmm. He at least has that, you know, writerly I don't know, instinct.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He knows that he's got to do something next month too. So
yeah, you know. Right.
Yep. Okay, so back on Midgard, which is Earth to you mere mortals, Dr. Doom is reading an article about how lame Dr. Blake is suddenly the world's greatest plastic surgeon. And he is so convinced that this is true that he travels all the way to America and is hanging out in the Latvian embassy.
Can I read the little article on the paper here?
Do.
So the headline from the Daily Bugle is, new plastic surgery method announced. Sensational breakthrough. And then it says, any face, no matter how disfigured, can be made normal again, says Dr. Donald Blake.
I love the slow news day.
Just the idea. It's the cover, and it's like the way it's like made normal again. It's just a very weird.
Yeah.
So Harris Hobbs works for the Daily Bugle.
Apparently.
Okay.
Oh.
We didn't know that.
Yeah, we haven't seen that before.
Also, yeah, new plastic surgery is a page one, like, bold print headline.
Right. No matter how disfigured. It's just such a weird thing.
Yeah, it's really like a sledgehammer to what should be a very delicate.
Like, if you have to wear an armored mask to hide your disfigurement, we can fix you.
Right.
Yeah.
Very subtle.
Yeah.
He's just weaving a subtle web of intrigue.
The page 11, Doom reading this news and processing it,
yeah,
and like losing his GD mind. Like,
yep.
I never really processed it before that, like, Doom is actually mentally ill. Like,
oh yeah.
Like, he's like, there's something very wrong with the way his brain works.
Yep.
I never really like did the math on it. Like, he reads this and like crumples the paper with desire and then like smashes the mirror.
Of course, he smashes a mirror.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That's on.
Anytime his face is mentioned, a mirror is going to get smashed.
He's just got like he's got a whole subterranean basement just filled with identical mirrors,
yeah,
and like his
yeah.
staff are just rotating in and out with fresh
yeah.
mirrors.
No,
Jamie, you just killed me, man. Seriously. The thing, just like innocently saying, it just occurred to me that Dr. Doom is mentally ill.
Well, he could be like evil without being like, he's not like the Joker, you know, like.
Yeah, but he wears armor that he never takes off, and he is.
He builds robots of himself.
He makes an earthquake that bomb under his castle to blow it up if somebody takes over it. Well,
he misses his mom and he's insecure about stuff. You know, he's the teen within all of us or whatever.
He's
somewhat of a poor loser.
Okay, I gotta get together.
Okay. Okay, so yeah. So okay, Doom trashes a newspaper, then a mirror, then he calls for a car so that he can pay lame Dr. Blake a visit. Because Blake's whole plan is, I can't go to Latveria because that would be a international
diplomatic incident.
Yeah, exactly. But I can make Doom come to me with my canny and subtle plan. So Doom heads over to lame Dr. Blake's office
with a sweet limo with a nice little drink cart situation.
Oh yeah,
his toady guy who has the worst hair.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a real butt cut.
Yeah.
instead of making an appointment with Dr. Blake or, you know, talking to him, Doom zaps him with a molecule displacer and flies him to Latveria, which Doom considers to be totally cool because he's ruler of a sovereign state and he enjoys total diplomatic immunity.
Oh my gosh. You were just there, dude. This is the longest route you could have possibly taken to get there.
The molecule outline this the art oh, from yeah. Buscema on yeah. this is so cool.
It is very cool.
It's like it's a very Steranko kind of thing, but also with Kirby-ness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A touch of Kirby crackle.
Yeah, yeah, some really cool pop art. Blake regains consciousness as they are zooming through the skies in Doom's fancy copter jet, which can span the ocean in a matter of fleeting minutes. Don't think about it too hard.
Oh, which they also accessed by hitting a button that made a tree pop open.
Yep.
And not open lateral, like not open like a cabinet, but open vertically.
Yes.
Yeah. in order to hit the next thing to open the mountainside cave door.
Yeah. Oh,
man, it was so extra. For a plane that he owns. Like
he could probably just park it at the embassy.
He could park it at the embassy. Yeah. Oh, well. He's got a flair for the dramatic. Doom leads lame Dr. Blake into his castle. He tells him that if he can fix his face, he'll be rewarded beyond his wildest dreams. Mm. But if he fails, then you shall learn the fullest measure of the wrath of Dr. Doom. Doom dims the lights. He lights some candles. It's very romantic.
Setting the mood, yes.
Yeah. Super romantic.
Then he pulls back his hood and starts to remove his mask.
Now, keep in mind, this whole plan... The only thing, whatever the actual plan is, the only thing that Dr. Blake has to do is be cool in this moment.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
That's the only criteria for this whole shenanigans.
He's a doctor.
He's a doctor.
He's been trained.
Yeah,
he's a surgeon.
Right, right.
He chops people up.
Yep.
And a human is now revealing their deepest shame to him.
Yep.
Now to execute the plan as planned.
Just be cool.
And for the, he's doing a pretty good job so far. In fact, I would say he's very aroused professionally. He says, I never suspected there could be such power, yet such rare sensitivity in those metal covered fingers. and Blake is such a professional that he plays it totally cool once Doom's face is revealed and says, oh no, no, in the name of heaven, I never dreamt it would be like that. There's nothing medical science can do, nothing. Oh
yeah, he could
this
not
is
be
turning into a real dramatic episode.
Yeah, he could not have done that worse. I would say. Yeah, it was like the worst thing he could have possibly done.
Yep. And Doom understandably flips out and throws Blake in his dungeon.
Yeah, I'm like, fair play, man. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, in this moment, like, I absolutely felt for Doom. Like,
yeah.
He put himself in this extremely vulnerable position. And then this Yahoo just responded in the absolute worst way possible.
Insanely.
Which I mean, also, I think is the plan, right? Because he needs to get thrown in the dungeon so that he can Thor out without anybody seeing him.
Or he could just go hang out longer, say, go to the bathroom.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Right.
I mean, he can do this anywhere.
The posture of Doom on page 19 in the top right is a real, like, don't look at, like, he's hunched over. We're seeing him kind of from the back and his arm is,
yeah,
like,
it's a Phantom of the Opera kind
yeah,
of
yeah, thank
move.
You. Thank yeah. you. That's, a, yeah. that's exactly it.
Very much so.
Speaking of musical theater, which nice. We were talking about yeah. before we started this.
Speaking of our theatrical episode.
Jeez, this is turning into our most theatrical episode.
Certainly
if you're going to do an episode all about Dr. Doom, you cannot not be theatrical.
Yeah, sure. That is a good point.
Yeah.
Should have thought of that up front.
But now we're in it.
The real stand.
Oh, we're in it now. Lame Dr. Blake is chained up in the dungeon. Doom's soldiers throw his walking stick in there with him, despite the fact that he's not going to be doing much walking, and it lands far from him. But Blake removes his shoe and uses a sort of a makeshift grappling hook to pull the stick toward him. Then it's Thor time. Thor busts out of the castle, flies into the sky. Doom's air defenses register an unidentified flying object streaking across the airspace. So he launches a Stalker missile at Thor, which he doesn't yet know is Thor. He just, something's in his airspace.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, I love Doom just like, bam, red button. Does not care.
Nope. Could be a commercial airliner that's gone slightly off course. Doom does not give an F.
Yeah, I felt like he also has red buttons everywhere and he doesn't even really know which one does what.
Right. Like, eh. I mean, he's definitely in a bad, his nerves are raw. His feelings are hurt.
For sure.
Yeah. Thor is going to easily outrun this missile, but then he realizes that if he does, it's going to hit and destroy a village below. So Thor has two choices, either let the village get blown up or get blown up himself.
Mm.
And that is our cliffhanger for this issue.
That is the deadly dilemma.
What? Yep.
Why did Thor just shoot into the sky in the first place? Why didn't he just like go like walk somewhere and bap Doom with a hammer? Or
yeah,
I guess he's looking for the missile silos, right?
I guess. Presumably. Yeah. Cause he's got, that's what he's there to do.
I forgot why we were here other than to totally screw up when you see Doom's face.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, that's just,
yeah.
That was a great issue. This has been I love the Doom Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. D-Day worked out well.
Yep. And I guess like I really do like I like this issue a lot, and I have to say, like, relative to a lot of Thor issues that we have read recently, where, you know, obviously Kirby's heart wasn't in it. Mm-hmm. And Stan was not engaged with the plotting or writing, right. Really.
Script after he gets a bunch of art.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, to the point where he wasn't even really giving a lot of direction and having Kirby have to go back and redraw a lot of things that he had plotted because they contradicted, you know, things that had already been established, like with Galactus's origin, you know, and all mm-hmm. that. It's nice to see Stan actually focused, and John Buscema just does great work in here.
I would not rather see a master not trying than someone maybe not at the top of their game putting in a full day's work.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think, I mean, Buscema at this point, I mean, you know, Kirby is Kirby and he lives in a plateau, but like Buscema's great. He is one mm-hmm. of the all-time greats. So, it's great to see him getting a shot at doing a book that I think he really has a flair for. And we're going to see a lot more of it. So,
yeah.
I'm pretty psyched. It portends good things.
Yay, verily.
All right. Well, on that note, we will take what I think is our final break of the episode. I am just looking at our runtime here, boys. We gotta make up some time. We got a lot of issues left. So,
oh boy.
You know what that means.
Sudden death.
Yep.
Dun, 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 sudden doom. Sudden.
We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. Okay, guys, as usual, we are running long. We are not even halfway through the list of Marvel comics that came out in September 1970. So that means, once again, it's time to hurl ourselves into the abyss that is Marvel by the Minute.
It's Marvel by the Minute.
We're going to put 60 seconds on the clock for each issue. Once the bell rings, it's time to move on to the next one. And fellows, before we get going on this, I have a piece of advice from a listener that just might save our sanity. El Jefe Primate wrote and said, "Now that all three of you have experienced the crucible that is Marvel by the Minute, I'm going to share with you the two most useful words in the English language. A phrase that will keep your flops unsweated, your blood unpressured, and leave you with enough spare time to enjoy a hearty snack and light aperitif before the buzzer heralds your minute's end. What linguistic Swiss Army knife will always safely MacGyver you to freedom when the dreaded deadline doom is about to chime for thee? Wackiness ensues."
Nice.
"The Monocle decides to threaten the United Nations with a camera ray? The FF show up. Wackiness ensues. Describe last panel. Mic drop. Roy Thomas brings us another tale of the Avengers. Tony asks for the rent check, and the Avengers have to get a job. Wackiness ensues, and no one gets evicted. Captain Marvel feels he spends too much time in the negativity zone. The Hulk wants to have more time in the friend zone. This odd couple meet, throw in some student protesters, and wackiness ensues. Hulk stays employed, and Captain Marvel goes on the dole for 2 years. Boom. You're covering the Marvel comics of the early 1970s. Not even the most pedantic can dispute that wackiness is inevitably ensuing. It's a golden ticket, a get-out-of-well-actually free card. Use this gift wisely and keep up the good work.
Aw, that was awesome. Thank you.
So there you go, fellas. That's when things are looking rough. And you're down to your last 5 or 10 seconds. That's your ripcord.
Okay.
So Rob, we're going to start with you.
Okay.
Normally we would cover Spider-Man, in the main section of the podcast. But we'd been pretty Spidey heavy the last few episodes.
And so. Dr. Doom didn't bother to show up in this.
And so. he didn't show up.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's not on us.
So, you're going to have the challenge of, explaining a fairly dense issue of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man number 91, To Smash the Spider, which was written by Stan Lee, the art's by Gil Kane and John Romita. 60 seconds on the clock, and go.
Okay, we start off at George Stacy, Captain Stacy's funeral, where Peter's holding Gwen. Peter's super bummed because Gwen hates Spider-Man because everyone thinks Spider-Man killed Captain Stacy. In fact, she hates him so much that she has decided to throw in with this jerk who's running for, I don't know, some job, some political job. He is on a Law and Order ticket. His name's Sam Bullitt, and he was a former police chief, I think, and he is all conservative all the time. In fact, so much so, he's running on the platform of getting Spider-Man and, I don't know, killing him, throwing him in jail, something. And he's not exactly a good guy. So he sends out some people to beat up Peter Parker so that he'll tell them how to find Spider-Man. Peter Parker pretends to get beat up and then tracks them down to find Gwen Stacy has volunteered with Sam Bullitt and is hanging out with them when Spider-Man swings into his own house to find them both.
Or nice! Her. Well done.
That was awesome.
You didn't even have to pull the ripcord.
Wow.
I guess they're
I
also
read that one twice just because I really hated that Sam Bullitt guy. So
yeah,
I don't know if anybody out there is going to be shocked to hear this, but I'm not too into Law and Order jerks.
Mm. Yeah.
He was also sweaty. He was like, and not in a cute way. He was like Nixon sweaty.
Yeah. He's also, you know, lying and doing underhanded things in order to make his vision of Law and Order happen.
Oh,
which
sure.
is also just
but mostly sweaty.
Yeah. But the sweaty,
that's the real,
it's off putting.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, we're off to a good start. This bodes well. Jamie, let's see if you can continue the momentum.
Oh, no. Right. Okay. It's coming back to me.
You are going to have to talk about the other story from Astonishing Tales number 3, Back to the Savage Land, written by Jerry Conway, which I think might be the first Jerry Conway story we have covered in Marvel by the Month. So.
Well, it's an honor then.
Yeah.
We'll cover all of it in a minute.
Yeah. to dedicate 1 minute to Mr. Conway. So anyway, the art is by Barry Not Yet Windsor Smith and Sam Granger. So it's only 10 pages. You got this. 60 seconds on the clock. Go.
Okay, everything looks very different than it did last time. Garrok is no longer purple, he's stone, and Kazar looks like a thin model man. They have to go back to the Savage Land because Zaladin is doing bad stuff, but then we're going to get a backstory of how Garrok became the stone guy. He was on a ship many, many years ago, and it crashed, and then eventually he drank from a cup that slowly turned him into a stone monster, and in one page it goes from dinosaur times to modern New York City, where he's wandering around trying to get Kazar to come back. When they get back, they bump into an old buddy whose family has been killed, and Kazar vows vengeance for them. And then Zaladin is marshaling the troops to fight, I guess, Garrok? Or against Garrok? I'm not sure. That part was confusing to me. They're Sun King worshippers. How am I doing? Yeah, I guess that's kind of it. I'm gonna call it.
All right. wackiness.
Wow, and wackiness ensues.
Nicely done.
Was Garak, did I get that wrong? In the name of Garak, he's Garak.
Yeah, it's like he's sort of becoming their god in some bizarre way. I don't understand either. I read it and I don't know.
Yeah, where they spent time in this issue was odd.
Yeah.
Like they could have not done, like taken a whole page of him like drowning in the ocean.
Sure.
And instead explained the things that were happening.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a couple of young guys finding their feet as far as comic storytelling goes, but Barry Smith's art is really leveled up, and it's not even as good as it's going to get. And yeah,
it's just it's very striking how different from the last issue, which was a Kirby thing.
Yes,
like
the last phoned in Kirby thing.
Yeah.
The stone guy was purple and wearing a purple outfit with a purple hat, and this he's like gray and scrawny. He's got like weird sketchy hairs, and
He looks it does look like Barry not yet. I mean, it looks like Barry fully Windsor Smith.
Yeah.
Just already you can see all of the trademarks of his art layout people, but it's just still, you know,
still
building,
cooking.
But you could tell it's him instantly.
For sure. Okay. Well,
Now you're up.
Now I'm up.
Suffer.
I am going to tell you about Avengers number 82. The story is called Hostage. It's written by Roy Thomas. The art's by John Buscema and Tom Palmer. I'm putting 60 seconds on the clock and starting it right now. Okay, so you remember how Captain America and Iron Man and Thor were like, we really need to go after Zodiac. Turns out they had a good instinct because in the very first couple pages, Zodiac takes over New York, led by Ares, the man with the horns. And other Avengers and other superheroes are trapped outside of the city, but Daredevil and Black Panther are still in the city. They wind up taking on Zodiac and they free the other Avengers who wind up. Look, they win. Okay. but it turns out that everyone had actually a good instinct because all the plots from the recent issues all tied together. Cornelius Van Lunt was bankrolling Zodiac. The Thunderbolts, the street gang, were involved somehow. And Ares was behind it all.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, not there you bad. Go.
We hit the same register.
Okay. Rob.
Oh, man.
Daredevil.
This one's gonna fall apart.
This is not a bad issue of Daredevil.
No, it was ripped from the headlines.
Ripped from the headlines. Daredevil number 70, The Tribune. Written by Gary Friedrich. Art by Gene Colan and Sid Shores. Your 60 seconds begins now.
Okay, we get it. This story is about an actor named Bob... What's his name? Ralston? Bill? What's his name? I don't know. He's like wearing a cowboy hat. He just reminded me of like Ronald Reagan from, you know.
I think he's meant to, yeah.
And he's running for office and he's on a, you know, something about patriots and silent majority, blah, blah, blah. Karen Page might get to act with him in a movie. She sort of gives him some political thoughts. And then meanwhile, is Daredevil back in town? No, in New York City, somebody's about to bomb Spiro T. Agnew, who is appearing at a talk. And it turns out it's plants from this dude called the Tribune, who is actually this actor, Bob, or Bill. Oh, man. Anyway, I'm confusing him with the guy from Amazing Spider-Man, too. But he has a gavel and he shoots lasers and kills people when they are hippies.
Ooh, yeah, that was pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, that's
the Daredevil was in there too. He swung around.
Also, Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that happened in here.
Yeah, yeah.
This was a deplorable character, and I really conflated this character with the character from Amazing Spider-Man.
Very much, yeah. And sadly, Spiro Agnew was not blown up.
Aw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of jokes about his golfing and things.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Real tame.
That must have been his gaffe.
You get the feeling that Friedrich really wanted to go after him harder, but
yeah,
he's being restrained to like that, you know, sort of Bob Hope level,
like a ribbing instead
gentle
of a,
ribbings. Uh-huh. Yeah,
but this is a big theme of very conservative people trying to make things worse.
Yeah,
and trying to take out anybody who's anti-establishment.
Yep,
and
yeah,
so and it's really overt. And I mean, I don't like my, you know, comics right, political. Right. Yeah, yeah. But
keep politics out of my comics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also the bombings, I think, are
they real? Was that a real
I
thing?
Think
they reference one that the real one that happened.
Yeah, I think they're meant to evoke that 1 month where the two bombers blew themselves up trying to make bombs. Was that Weather Underground?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
I mean, not funny.
not funny, haha. There were a lot of bombings in the 70s. Like,
yeah, Walter Cronkite says this. There's bombs that there's tear gas that, you know, there's whatever riot and police being tear gassing and hitting people. And this could turn into a tragedy, which may parallel that of 1968 in Chicago.
Talking about the Democratic National Convention. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Typically when Marvel touches on things, especially when Stan's doing it, it's sort of like, this is a stand-in for something similar.
Mm.
Friedrich's just going straight for it.
He just went for it,
yeah.
Which is kind of awesome.
Yeah, and it was a good issue of Daredevil, because Daredevil mostly wasn't in it.
Yeah. Yep.
Those are the best ones.
That's really what the story is. Like, I didn't have to mention Daredevil. No. Just about these other characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I barely did.
All right. Jamie.
Yeah.
You are going to be talking about Fantastic Four number 105. The monster in the streets.
Isn't that half an expression?
Yeah.
There's a second half to that expression.
So, Fantastic Four 105, written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita, still giving it his best. God bless him. And John Verpoorten. You have 1 minute, which starts right now.
The Thing, the Torch, and Crystal are eating hot dogs on the street. Crystal starts not feeling well, and a building starts falling on Ben. Ben props up the building while Johnny Storm flies Crystal back to the Baxter building so Reed can fix her. Meanwhile, we get some flashback of Fantastic Four. Sue's shopping. She sees some crazy energy stuff happening outside. Some science guy shows up who seems to know her. He's an old colleague of Reed's, and he's like, no, there's a person in that energy stuff. We have to figure this out. And then Reed is like working on Crystal with Johnny. And he's like, oh no, this is worse than I thought. She's like dying of pollution and has to go back home.
Ah, pollution.
Pollution's the worst. And then Ben Grimm shows up and he's like, oh, okay, I was holding up that building. Things are really bad. Crystal has to go. She has to leave forever, and they're very sad about that. And then Reed ultimately at the end has to choose between saving Sue from the energy thing and Ben Grimm's transformation. Ah, I left out the whole Ben Grimm thing.
It's pretty good.
That was a key bit to leave out.
Well,
so am I allowed to
go ahead
rebuild the house of cards there? So the thing that was wrong with Crystal gave Reed a clue as to how to fix Ben.
Right.
So he's like mid operation on Ben.
Yeah.
When Johnny, when the thing comes in, is like, hey, you got to go save Sue.
Yeah.
So he's got a real Sophie's choice on whether to. Because if he doesn't fix Ben right then, it will never happen.
It'll never work.
Right.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't save his wife, she won't exist.
Right. Which, I mean, how much does she really exist for him now?
Yeah, yeah.
This doesn't seem like it'd be that difficult of a choice for Reed.
Yeah. But, yeah, he's real upset. Johnny Storm's real upset.
Everybody's upset.
The Thing's paralyzed in a chair waiting for his fate to be decided.
Yeah. It's a high drama in the Baxter building. And we're going to cut to unnamed European country. Actually, it's probably named, but I've forgotten the name of it. This is Incredible Hulk number 134. The story is called Among Us Walks the Golem. It's written by Roy Thomas. Art is by Herb Trimpe and Sal Buscema. And I'm going to tell you all about it starting right now. Okay, so the thing that really the only interesting thing about this story is that the nation that is under the rule of the dictator.
Draxon?
Draxon the dictator.
Draxoff.
The folks who he's repressing are Jewish. We find out about this because the daughter of the leader of them The little girl sees the Hulk in the woods, and she thinks he's the Gollum. And then he tells the story. The leader tells his family the story of the Gollum and how it rose to their people's aid when they needed it. So anyway, long story short, Hulk looks like he's not going to help the people. Then he winds up helping the people, and he basically trashes the whole place, including a sweet robot thing that Draxon created. And then when he's given the opportunity to become king, he crushes the Amulet of Power, and he gives up the chance to rule the country.
Solid. And dramatically catches a little girl's tear at the end.
Oh, yes. Can't dodge that.
Nope.
That would be rude. Okay. Rob, you get an Iron Man story not written by Archie Goodwin.
Yeah, it sure isn't.
Iron Man.
Yeah.
Iron Man, you say.
Yeah, you're going to vaguely remember it when I start to describe it, but then forget it again instantly, like I did.
It's sort of
right, with the guy.
It's like those Doctor Who villains that, you know, as soon as you look away from them, you forget they're there.
That's why the show is called Who?
Who? Yeah.
Am I the first person ever to make that joke? I have to be, right?
Sure, yeah. Let's give it to yourself. Folks, please do not tweet at us if Jamie's not. It will break his little heart.
We try so hard.
Okay, Rob, this is Iron Man number 32. The story is Beware the Mechanoid, written by Alan Brodsky, art by George Tuska and Joe Guadioso, a.k.a. Mike Esposito. Are you ready-ish?
I guess.
All right.
I'll screw this up.
Give it a shot.
Okay. So we get four plot that threads. Iron Man's testing his suit. There's a black couple, that a date gone wrong. Lady's driving home. We get a spaceman who looks like a metal guy with like a weird bad blonde wig on and orange stuff. And we get some escaped criminals. These all come together. Iron Man has to get involved. He finds out that this spaceman, the Mechanoid, is a colonist or representing a colonist of some interstellar group that wants to make this, you know, some kind of trading colony. Once he says trading, Tony Stark's like, well, maybe that's something bad. And then they get this Mechanoid ends up turning into a black man who gets a ride with this lady who was on the date and headed home. But then they end up getting taken hostage by the criminals who escaped. Wackiness ensues. The Mechanoid gets shot to death.
That issue is like a long walk to where it goes.
Yeah.
Like it just takes a while to get there and a lot of pieces.
Starman with a sort of fish out of water that has to learn about being a black man in some ways. And,
right, but doesn't really.
But doesn't really.
Doesn't really. Yeah, and then gets shot a bunch and blows up.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, close enough.
Close enough.
That's our aim.
Yeah. Okay, Jamie, one left to go.
Oh, you got this.
Submariner number 32. The story is called Call Her Lyra, Call Her Legend.
Damn.
It's written by Roy Thomas, art by Sal Buscema and Jim Mooney. You ready to go?
Oh, God, I'm already lost. Okay. Yeah, let's bring it on.
This bodes well. Go.
All right, Namor is sciencing with his chief science guy, and they are detecting a disturbance. We get a bunch of like flashbacky stuff. Ultimately, Namor decides he needs to go to Lemuria to team up with them. He rides an underwater stingray and takes a nap on it for a little bit. Very specifically discussed. He gets to Lemuria, where he's taken prisoner, and then he asks to see the male leader, but the male leader is no more. Instead, it is Lyra or Lyra. Who wants to enslave him and use him and team up, I guess. We get the origin story of her and like her mom. There were like three generations of these people. It was very confusing. There are twins involved. Namor breaks free, tries to conquer her back. Namor's in a cage.
Oh, geez, he's falling apart.
Oh, I can't do it. Oh my god,
the pressure got to him.
The pressure. Oh my gosh,
the pressure of being all those fathoms down.
There's just too much story.
It's yeah,
like Lyra and her twin are the same person,
and
that's the
twist at the end.
Yeah,
but like Lyra's basically a human hybrid
with a Lemurian.
She's a Lady Namor.
Yeah. She's a Lady Namor from Lemuria, not Atlantis.
Right.
It's separate. But then, like, the flashback isn't about her. It's about the mom.
Yeah.
The mom who, so instead of a, like, Namor was, it was a human male sailor who met a lady Atlantean, and they had a Namor.
Gross.
This is the it's a gender swapped version of that.
Okay.
So it's a Lemurian dude and a human woman, and they make twins. But it's only one baby.
Right. Yeah, she's when, like a split when, personality.
When she switches to normal human, she doesn't remember that she's also her sister.
So she's kind of like a Hulk.
Yeah, she's kind of like a Hulk.
Yeah, it's a really weird story, and I didn't have high hopes for you, and I
I did not disappoint.
I love
in your expectation.
I love how dumb we sound at the end of these now that we're doing Marvel by the Minute, that it makes us sound, even though we probably never sound smart, we sound smarter when we start.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this really absolutely takes any ounce of energy or coherence out of us. That's why we save it for the end.
Yeah.
So we can limp across that finish line.
Yeah. And I'm doubly wounded by this process because I just remember thinking, like, why can't Rob get this together, man? Like, you read the comics, you say what happened in the comics.
It's harder than it sounds, folks. Yeah. Try it at home.
That ticking clock. It's like before a flashback in Lost, it's just like, da-gunk, da-gunk. Yeah. Or 24. Sorry.
Yeah. I want to do sometime for a live show, I want to like offer some people to read a comic and try to do Marvel by the Minute.
Right.
Yeah. You can win a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And suffer.
Yep.
that's just what I call it, obviously, since I say it. I like to say it to you specifically because Brian, you know, got to just watch me
do this
painfully so much. So when he gets to do one now, I like to say
when
suffer.
When he gets to do one.
When he has the privilege.
Phrase we're going with.
Yep. Okay, well, let's turn the page on all this. We didn't even have to pull the Wackiness and Zeus card this time.
That's true.
It's like, we'll get to it next time.
I don't think we have the aptitude to be able to pull the Wackiness.
Like, right.
We're so dumb, we don't even realize we're in trouble.
Yeah, we can't set it up in time to say Wackiness and Zeus and summarize it. Or say the last panel. We are... Maybe someday, if we keep trying.
We'll keep working.
You need to wiggle an arm for you to grab the escape hatch.
Okay, well, let's move on to our final segment, our recommendations. I'm going to propose that we rename this section. Every time I try to type the title of the comic book Astonishing Tales, I always type Astonishing Takes. So I've decided that we're going to call this segment Astonishing Takes.
Yeah,
I like it.
My astonishing take is that Young Avengers by Alan Heinberg and Jim Cheung is really good. So I am super late to this party because I am a curmudgeonly old man who immediately hated the idea of Marvel's Teen Titans. I refused to engage with it on any level, but I kept hearing great things about it from a lot of people whose opinions I respect an awful lot. It gradually wore me down, so I picked up the complete collection of the original issues. Small spoiler alert here. It turns out that I kept hearing great things about it because it's great.
Oh!
Yeah.
Twist.
It is not the comic that you think it is on the surface. It does a really good job of sort of leading you down a set of expectations and then subverting those. The closest thing I can compare it to would be Kurt Busiek's original Thunderbolts run. But Thunderbolts leaned really heavily on one twist, which I think most people are aware of at this point, but if you're not, I'm not going to mention it. It's a very, very good plot twist.
That they were dead the whole time?
Yeah, exactly.
They were all dead.
But if the twist is spoiled for you, like, that takes a chunk out of what's special about the book.
Mm-hmm. Or any M. Night Shyamalan movie.
It is kind of like that. Yeah, exactly. So Young Avengers, like, in basically every issue, there's a twist or a reveal. And the series as a whole is this, like, just beautifully constructed series of callbacks to this wide swath of the history of the Marvel Universe. But even if you had every single one of these things spoiled for you, it's still, underneath it all, is a really great coming-of-age story. It delivers on the promise of teen superhero drama extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, on one level, it is sort of a basket of Easter eggs for Marvel nerds. It's also so much more than that. So don't be like me. Just read it. You're going to probably love it.
I was thinking it would be great if we had a list of all the things that we've recommended.
Oh, yeah.
So
we'll add that to the website in all of our free time.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Maybe someone can make it for us.
Yeah, make it for us, please.
Or give us, you know, sign up for Patreon and we'll get enough money that somebody will have time to put that on.
Yeah, right. By an hour.
Yes.
Okay. Well, what I did during our break, in addition to reading tons and tons of other comics, I read a whole bunch of Sweet Tooth, which is Jeff Lemire doing writing and most of the art, as he does for most of the series. Specifically, Sweet Tooth Book 2, Sweet Tooth Book 3, and Sweet Tooth The Return.
Yeah.
I had read the earlier stories back in 2009 on when they came out. So so I was into that, and then I just sort of didn't read them for a decade.
Oh.
So there's the whole Netflix thing, and I was like, maybe I should see what's up with the rest of that story.
Yeah.
Although the Netflix story just covered things I already knew in a lighter way. But that's the point, is that the book is, it looks sort of cartoonish when you see the art, and it is a dark story, like very dark, like to me as dark as Walking Dead, the comic.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think the Netflix show obviously does that justice, but that's probably on purpose to not like be the road.
Right. Right.
So, you know, basically I love any apocalyptic tale, and it's up there with the darkest of them. Mm-hmm. The thing I had missed with my decade hiatus was the origin of the animal people, which I'm not going to tell you, but I really didn't know if it was something they were going to even get to. I thought it was going to maybe be like a Romero zombie thing where they're like, this is just the world we live in.
Right.
So nobody, we don't have time to figure this out.
Right. Yeah. And if you're not familiar with Sweet Tooth, there are a bunch of like basically animal human hybrids, like, and the titular Sweet Tooth is a young boy who is like a deer.
Yeah, he has antlers
hybrid.
And
yeah.
So does humanity welcome these people who are different than
humanity loves a difference.
Loves a difference.
And humanity in general isn't having children, normal children that survive.
Oh,
so,
whoa.
So
there's a little bit of Children of Men in there.
Yeah.
So it's got a, it's just, it's great, but it's dark. It's like you gotta be willing, if you've seen the show and you want to read the comic, don't expect even anywhere, like it's three levels darker than that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's some grim moments for sure. Yeah.
So, but I was really happy. I wanted it to just be like, it's a mystery. No one gets to know. It's just the way it is.
Like that sometimes.
But I was happy that the mythos, the things that Jeff Lemire pieces together for this are so huge that it's, It drew me back in. I was like, okay, I'm cool with this. It was sort of like a lost ride where you're like,
oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, I was appealing to Jamie specifically. So anyway, read it. It's really great. Read it if you're ready for the darkness. Don't go into it thinking it's going to reflect that show. It does reflect the show quite well, but that show seems like a lighthearted romp compared to the comic.
Yeah.
Wow.
I haven't read The Return yet. I own it, but I haven't gotten to it. But I did fairly recently, within the last couple, 3 years, read the whole series. And it's great. It's really, really good. It was one of the things that really convinced me that Lemire is one of the best people. Just one of the greatest talents in the business today.
His body of work is going to be astronomical.
Yeah. It's already huge.
Yeah.
Like his output is ridiculous.
And like I said last week, I think, you know, it's so varied.
Yeah.
It's just, he doesn't have a style you can instantly see or feel. He goes with whatever that story is, whatever that universe is, whatever that character is.
Yeah. His style is sad.
Yeah. Sad. Sad is the thread. Yeah. there's really big moments. So,
So I don't know if this has ever happened on the show before, but Brian stole mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. He used to do this to me all the damn time.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can prove it because of one of my book clubs. Like, so Young Avengers was the next, in that. So yeah, so I
that's another point for me. Mark that down.
It's like, I got to start entering these notes earlier. All right. So as listeners may be slowly picking up on, I have a pretty fundamental disconnect with DC's main stable of superhero content. So if I'm recommending a DC thing, which I am about to do here, it's because someone super smart and awesome made me read it. And that is the case with this week's pick of Harley Quinn Breaking Glass. Is this a thing people know about? Have you heard of that?
I don't think I have.
Okay. Mm-hmm. My copy is like not a full length. It's like not like a standard trade paper. It's like stubbier.
Okay.
And the art is a little like manga-y. So I don't know if it's like maybe more in that world. But
okay. Yeah.
So like my definitive Harley Quinn is from the Batman animated cartoon. Like that's just the age I am and my involvement with DC.
Mm-hmm.
So anything besides that always feels like they're sort of forcing this level of derangement on her that like feels tacked on.
She's just twisted.
Yeah. I like her take in that cartoon is like a lot more innocent and bubbly.
Mm-hmm.
So I never, whatever. This is like a high school origin story, and it like it backs away from that in a really cool way. She has this like innocent zaniness that you could kind of like taffy stretch into a later derangement.
Okay.
In a way that's like satisfying. Like you can draw those lines if you want to, but like I don't know if this is canon. I don't know if it counts.
Is anything canon in DC anymore?
Oh gosh. Like, yeah. Yeah. See my previous statement. and similarly, there's a whole like Joker theme approach where it's like you see those elements and they're throughout, but it's like not in a winking at the camera kind of way. And there's like fascinating themes about like clowns and disguises and costumes that like I'm sure a smarter person would be able to assemble into like a coherent thought. I know that they're in there. So on the surface, it's like this goofy but touching coming of age tale with like a heaving dollop of like that awesome X-Men style found family story.
Cool.
In this case, there's like these fabulous and this loving drag queen community, and they're kind of facing off against like a literal and metaphorically evil gentrification process. And it's like feminist and inclusive in all the best ways and not in the worst ways that some people have problems with. There's like cool metaphors, there's corruption and temptation, and the art style is like not my thing. Like this is not something I ever would have picked up on my own. I found myself really enjoying it.
Cool.
There's like an evolution of color that happens as the story progresses in a way that is like smart.
Cool.
And I was very impressed by that. So it was manga that I didn't hate, and I just wanted to thank my friend who recommended it. And thanks to Brian for stealing my pick.
Anytime. I mean, I'm probably going to do it again. Apparently that's my MO. So.
Panel of the month. That was the other thing.
Yeah.
He used to steal those from me.
Oh, right.
And that's the thing. You got to get your notes in before Brian somehow, which almost
is hard
impossible.
Because I set them up.
He set them up. Yeah. The deck is stacked.
Yep. Yeah. It's true.
It's the real gambit of picking stuff and writing it down. my brain checked out halfway through that sentence.
Oh my God. I think, you know what? I think we're tired. Let's just wrap it up. I think we are, it could not be clearer that we are running on fumes. So, hey, if you want more of this, why don't you subscribe to our Patreon? The price is fantastic. $4 a month. patreon.com/marvelbythemonth is where you need to go for that. You get exclusive content if you do it. Review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. If you would like to get some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. We have a bunch of stuff left over with our old logo on it that we're gonna need to unload, so
yeah,
get those reviews,
age that out.
Find us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month and Twitter at MarvelBTM. Check one or both of those to find out the details for our 150th episode live show on March 30th.
Oof, coming so soon.
Which might be tonight, depending on when you hear this.
Right, hopefully
it's still happening. Who knows? Check those socials. MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Thank you so much for listening. That is all for now. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
We'll see you next week for next month. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.